On March 16, 2000, two sheriff's deputies were shot in Atlanta. Jameel Al-Amin, a Muslim leader and former Black Power activist, was convicted. But the evidence was shaky, and the whole truth didn't come out during the trial. My name is Mosi Secret, and when I started investigating this case in my hometown, I uncovered a dark truth about America. From Tenderfoot TV, Campside Media, and iHeart Podcasts, Radical is available now. Listen to the new podcast, Radical, for free on the iHeart Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
How was that period of that was the only sustained period of being separate?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How was that?
It was rough. You really start to learn a lot about yourself when you have to live life as a singleton. You have to live life as an individual.
Like, it's tough.
It's crazy.
It's very hard.
You're just stuck with your thoughts. I became super insecure. I was not confident in my abilities intellectually. Like, it just became like this.
I realized how much I leaned on my brother just for emotional and intellectual support.
Yeah.
Like, when I was by myself, I was like, holy shit, I don't understand how people do this.
Yeah.
Just live like an individual.
Yeah,
it's just too much work.
It's
a burden.
That's the Lucas brothers. They're twins named Kenny and Keith. They're two stand-up comedians / philosophers who are brilliant and dry and hysterical. They're now part of Jimmy Fallon's Tonight Show, and they're working on a sitcom for CBS All Access, and they're doing another stand-up routine for HBO, and they already have one on Netflix that's called On Drugs, because they smoke a lot of weed, and they're just awesome. So let's get into it. It's the Lucas Brothers on Touré Show. So who's Keith and who's Kenny?
He's Keith.
I'm Keith.
And I'm Kenny.
Okay.
Yeah.
What is the difference?
In terms of personality
physically,
or physically,
Personality, metaphysically.
What would you say? I would say Kenny was born first, so it's
Five minutes?
5 minutes. Yeah. I've taken on the 5 more minutes of wisdom.
Precisely.
I've taken on the characteristics of the older brother.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it doesn't make any sense.
Right.
Because I don't, 5 minutes is not significant.
Not at all.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think, what are some differences? I mean, he's slightly bigger.
Yeah. I weigh five more pounds.
Maybe.
What about metaphysically?
Metaphysically, I feel like we're pretty much aligned philosophically.
Yeah.
I would say, I mean.
For a while though, I would say I was more of a materialist and he was more of an idealist, right?
The other way around.
I was more of an idealist and he was more of a materialist.
Or more of a pragmatist. I wouldn't say materialist.
Yeah.
I would say I was slightly more pragmatic and he was slightly more idealistic. But now we're starting to meet in the middle.
Yeah. I mean, quite often, you know, brothers and sisters of all sorts, whether or not you're twins, you want to have some differentiating factor.
Why?
Why do you want that?
Yeah, why?
Yeah, because you want to assert who you are as a person.
So
right?
we question that.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
We question the people trying to assert who they are, because I feel like we're all interconnected. There's no such thing as the individual you. I think that's just the concept. We're all made up of subatomic particles. We're all, you know, we all kind of live and then die. I mean, are we really that distinct aside from the differences that we've created in our minds, like race, class,
gender,
all
that stuff? I see what you're saying in that we are part of the community that we are part of, which is global and also local and
cosmic,
also hyper-local,
cosmic,
all of that. But we do we not have an intrinsic desire to be seen as unique in some way? I mean, you guys get on stage. You're not saying, I'm just another person, just another cog in the machine. Just the act of, like, I get on stage, look at me. You're saying, I'm different than the rest of you human beings.
Well, I don't know if it's intrinsic. That's the thing. I don't know if it's an intrinsic desire. It may be external forces pushing us to believe that we need to define ourselves in this individualistic manner.
Yeah, right? It could just be a byproduct of industrialization and capitalism that makes us believe that we're distinct. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know if we've felt that way for all of, you know, human existence.
Yeah.
Like, I know growing up, you know, my sister and I, we're not twins, but we're Irish twins, right? we wanted to seem different from each other. So if I was into X, then she was like, well, I'm not into that. Why?
Yeah,
because he likes it, so I need to be individual. And I wonder, there must be some point of differentiation where you're like, you know, Kenny does not like Call of Duty 3, but I do.
Yeah.
Just to have some point where there must be some point where the Venn diagram does not overlap.
I find that bizarre. I think, like, if you like it, you like it. Like, you shouldn't want to differentiate yourself simply because it's something that you can do. Like, we all eat food. Why do we have, like, how far does it go? Like, how far do we go in terms of trying to differentiate ourselves from the next person when in reality we're all pretty much the same?
We're all pretty much the same.
There are very few. I mean, if you looked at it on a subatomic level, there are very few differences. And so I think that we have a yearning to differentiate ourselves from one another because it's something that's kind of forced upon us.
Yeah.
We get genders, we get race,
we get a name,
we get a social security number. It's like we find ways to make ourselves different
when in reality we're kind of the same. Yeah.
So often in your comedy, for me at least, the laugh point is when one of you does, what do you call it? Like, yeah.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
What would you even call that?
I would call it the hype man. You know, you see it in hip hop a lot. You see the person who sort of hypes the MC up, and I think we sort of adopted that style because it's somewhat unique, I suppose, but it also allows for us to, I don't know, help each other out while we're on stage.
You must have a philosophy on why am I and others finding that funny that you're spitting your actual game and then you're just like, that's right. And that's funny. That's right isn't even funny, no. But you're like, that's right. And it's just because you said that's right. Like, it's so funny. Is it the timing? Is it
I think it's timing. I think it's something you don't really see often in comedy. So it could be the uniqueness of it that makes people laugh. What do you think?
It's silly. It's
silly.
It's two grown men dressed alike talking at the same time. It's ridiculous. But it's funny.
Not specific to you, but what makes something funny? Why do I laugh at this joke and not that joke? Why do I laugh at this point of the joke and not that point?
There are a lot of theories on why people laugh. I mean, some people laugh at the incongruity of jokes, like, you know, setting up something to
go one way.
Yeah.
And then violating that supposed norm.
Which Jeselnik does
very Jeselnik,
well.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't expect where he's going to go.
He relies heavily on the incongruity, but also there's just like silly things what people see, like slipping on a banana peel. You laugh at that.
That's why Instagram's so popular, because they don't really like write out their jokes, and it's not like, you know, formalized, but it's funny because it's silly and it's like bodily and physical. I don't know. Why do you?
It's a very complex thing. It's a very complex. Like, what is consciousness? Why do people laugh? We don't really, truly, truly, truly understand. I mean, there's a multitude of reasons why people laugh. I don't know why I laugh. I mean, I laugh at certain well-written jokes.
I thought John Witherspoon was hilarious. I always laughed at him. I think. Yeah. Why did he make me laugh?
Yeah. Why did John Witherspoon make a lot of people laugh?
John Witherspoon was great, like a Bernie Mac.
Oh yeah.
That just the voice,
yeah.
Yep.
He could just say hello,
yeah,
and you would laugh.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, other comics got to do the work and make a joke, and then you laugh at the intellectual work.
Yeah, or, I mean, he created a great comedic character that you could just fit in. I mean, you can just put in any situation, and it would be funny. I mean, he wasn't really stylistically different in any of the roles he was in, but because that character was so funny,
and it took him years to figure out that character. Like, he had been on a scene in L.A. for a number of years, and then he just finally figured it all out. And then the character was portable across mediums.
I felt like he was old for 50 years, you know? Like, it felt like he was an old man for 50 years.
Yeah,
I think he just needed time to evolve to that character.
Yeah,
Aren't old comedians sort of doing a character?
I think so.
So you're doing a version of yourselves on stage.
A heightened version.
Yeah.
I wouldn't even say it's too close to who we are off stage. I mean, it's certainly just it's like wrestling almost. You create this character.
Yeah.
And you try to, you know, make it close, not close, but somewhat like who you are, who you want to be.
Yeah.
I mean,
in a heightened sense.
If you're going to be on stage every night, it better be close to you, right? Like, it can't be completely divergent. Then you have to be a real actor, right?
It really depends. I mean, it depends on which what you're going
for. Off stage, I'm not as like calm and casual. I'm certainly not as funny. I think I'm more neurotic. It's just weird. I feel like the person I play on stage and on TV and stuff like that is different from who I am in real life.
For sure. I would say there are some differences, without a doubt.
I mean, I already see the dryness and the drollness that we get on stage starts to fade away as we have just a natural conversation.
Sure. Absolutely.
Sure.
I think it's
more planned. Like, mm-hmm. It's like, you got the joke and you rehearse it and you try it on stage across the country or across the world, and it's like you get a certain rhythm.
But now, see, like Chris Rock, for example, he's more of, when he's on stage, he feels more like a Southern preacher.
He's bombastic,
He's bombastic, he's screaming at you. But when he's off stage, he's very, very low key, and or even Chappelle for that matter. These guys are very, very low key off stage. Mm-hmm.
They're almost like conserving their energy for the stage.
Sure.
And that is honestly who Rock is. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I interviewed Cat Williams once and it really threw me off because he was very low energy.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I expected, way up here. And you come in and you're basically like, he was very professional. Mm-hmm. But I was like, are you okay? Are you tired? Like, what's going on? You know? And I was thrown off. It was hard. It's not, whereas when I see Sarah Silverman, she seems much closer to the person on stage, off stage.
Hmm. Some people, some people want, I think they stay in character for the most part. Whereas some people are willing to just turn it off.
Because you got a guy like Kat, he's doing, he was doing stadiums at the height, and he'll probably get back to that at some point. But like, he had to like really bring it. Rock does stadium, so you have to bring it.
Like a rock star almost.
Yeah.
He's literally performing like a rock star, and I guess you just can't be like that 24/7. For some comedians.
You guys like Stephen Wright?
Yeah.
He's a legend.
Yeah,
he destroyed me.
He's a
clever writer, a clever performer, just great.
Mm-hmm. Really, really smart.
Yeah.
Who are some of the folks who you... I know you've talked about the Sklar brothers, mm-hmm. are influences.
Yeah.
Stephen Wright seems to be a clear influence.
Sure.
Who else?
So many. I mean, Chris Rock, obviously. Yeah. Chappelle. Wanda Sykes. Who else would this
Larry
say?
David.
Larry David.
Yeah.
Jerry
Seinfeld.
Yeah.
Yeah, Seinfeld.
I like Tina Fey.
Tina Fey's
great.
Great writing. Gary Shandling.
Yeah.
Mm, who else? Who else did we? Martin Lawrence.
See, I see you a lot different than a lot of the folks you mentioned. And I find it interesting when you talk about the destruction of the ego, right? Hmm. Or the egocentric presentation.
Yeah.
Because especially the comedy that... I'm a little older than you, but the comedy that we all sort of grew up watching, especially the superstar black comic,
mm-hmm.
Eddie Murphy, and then Chris Rock, and then Chappelle.
Yeah.
And, obviously playing off of the influence of Pryor.
Yeah, sure.
And it's very much like, I am brilliant. I'm not a clown. I'm an alpha. Mm-hmm. I'm going to stand here and spit my brilliance.
Yeah.
And you're going to laugh. And yes, we did all that.
Yeah.
And, a lot of white comics are like, I'm a clown of some sort. And these black comics are like, no.
Well, I think that's a byproduct of Hollywood. Like, in Hollywood, as a white comic, you just have more range. You're not limited to just like this one spot. And you can see a Seth Rogen, a Jonah Hill, Stephen Curry. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
you
yeah.
just have a plethora of opportunities as a white comic. Whereas for a while, black comics were literally limited to one spot.
Yeah,
you had the one superstar comic, and then everyone else was getting maybe supporting roles, maybe guest spots. You couldn't like transcend and become a superstar. But now I think that's being broken down a lot more. I think you're getting a situation where you're getting more black comics have an opportunity to show us. Sort of show their range.
Mm-hmm.
What was the desire in you to break down the ego presentation, right? Which we said was like, I am brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
I am alpha.
Well, it's not realistic.
It's also our shared experience. I mean, growing up as twins, we've always had to share. We've never really been referred to as, or I never really referred to myself in an I situation. It was always been we.
Yeah.
And so... I think our experience sort of took us away from presenting ourselves in such an egocentric way. We sort of rejected the individualistic manner of how stand-ups present themselves because, again, we were a duo. Yeah.
I think so.
And I think it also, like, if you want to do comedy that's, I don't want to be sweeping, but I think if you want to touch into more emotionally honest comedy, you have to question the, the role of the ego.
Of course, you have
to question yourself, and you have to say, okay, I'm not perfect. I do make mistakes, and I want to share that with the audience. I don't want to have to pretend to be someone I'm not. You know what I mean? I want to be able to talk about addiction, and I want to be able to talk about failures. And I think certain forms of comedy don't allow for you to really delve into that stuff, the emotionally messy stuff. And I think that that was sort of an inclination to sort of move in a different direction.
Mm. So how do you write? How do you create? What does that look like?
Well, I mean, normally it's very open and free flowing. We wake up in the morning and we'll just start talking.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll talk about whatever politics or what's going on in our lives. And
thank God for Google Docs.
Google Docs is the greatest.
We'll do a plug for Google Docs.
It allows for us to just sort of write our ideas out and share them throughout the day. But it's a very free flowing process. We try to just like communicate with each other often.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're laughing at something, we'll try to turn that into a joke.
Yeah.
So, for example, we take Sharp James. He was the mayor of Newark for a long time. We will just talk about him.
Yeah.
And we're like, oh, we need a joke about Sharp James. I think that'll work into our set. So mm-hmm. we'll talk and talk and talk and riff. And then one of us will go off and just try to write out a joke.
Mm-hmm.
That's the semblance of a joke.
Yeah.
So I wrote out this bit that I was just trying to work out. And then he looked at it and said, I don't know if that punchline works. And he tweaks it, and mm-hmm. then we just try it on stage to yeah. see if it works.
Yeah.
But that's just stand-up. When it comes to, like, screenwriting,
it's also similar. We'll map out, like, for our set, let's say we're doing a one-hour set and we want it to be a narrative. We'll break it down into four acts. It'll be 15 minutes per act. And we try to plug in where we think we need jokes. And then once we feel like we have a complete piece, we'll say, okay, we're ready to try to get money for it. But for like a same thing with a pilot or a TV, or a film script, we'll break it down into acts. So if a movie's, 2 hours, that'll be 40 beats per film.
Mm-hmm. Right? 40 to 60.
40 to 60 beats. And then we'll try to work out the skeleton of the film. And then we'll go to each, we'll work on beats individually and try to make it a full scene. And then we'll go off and write.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty much that.
Yeah. And we try to just, we communicate often and we try to, we share ideas as often as possible. Yeah. And
it's a lot of research.
A lot of research. And yeah. We try not to be precious about our ideas. It's
no.
like whatever we think works the best, we put in. We try not to have an ego
about it.
We used
to fight a lot about shit.
When we first started.
Mm-hmm. But now we don't give a shit. Like,
no,
it's like
no, no.
We trust each other. And
you fought about whose
fought,
ideas.
Fought about
whose ideas.
Ideas.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
We started to buy into this. I mean, when we separated for law school and, for the first time I was referred to by my first name.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that I started to develop a bit of an ego.
Yeah.
And so when we got into comedy, I still had that ego.
Same.
He still had his ego. And as we, worked a little bit more and closer with one another, that the ego started to shed again.
Yeah.
How was that period? Wait, who went to Duke?
I went to Duke.
And you went to NYU.
Keith
went to NYU, yeah.
How was that period of, that was the only sustained period of being separate?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How was that?
It was rough. You really start to learn a lot about yourself when you have to live life as a singleton. And you have to live life as an individual.
Like, it's tough.
It's crazy.
It's very hard.
You're just stuck with your thoughts. I became super insecure. I was not confident in my abilities intellectually. Like, it just became like this.
I realized how much I leaned on my brother just for emotional and intellectual support.
Yeah.
Like, when I was by myself, I was like, holy shit, this is, I don't understand how people do this.
Yeah.
Just live like an individual.
Yeah,
it's just too much work. It's
yeah,
like
yeah.
a burden. But when you're with your brother, it's like you wake up in the morning and it's like, I instantly have a partner.
Mm-hmm.
But I sort of understood why people want to get married and find wives. It's like, they just want that partner to share some of the burden of existence with.
Yeah.
Sometimes you need stories that reflect the community, the culture, the world that you love. You can get some of that on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths, where you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and how to create world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is an account of what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective and diving into the things that we care about and the stories we want to hear that center Black perspectives. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes that celebrate the Black experience. Turn on NPR and listen to Black Stories, Black Truths, because Black stories make up what it means to be in America, and stories should never be told without us. Listen to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR wherever you get your podcasts. Back in 2018, Trump's Border Patrol separated thousands of refugee kids from their parents, deported the parents back to their home countries, while keeping the kids in the United States, separating and destroying hundreds of families. It was heartbreaking. And years later, hundreds of families still have not been reunified. I recently learned about an organization that's trying to make a difference. It's El Atrolado, and it works to reunify families, providing holistic legal and humanitarian support to refugees, deportees, and other migrants in America and Tijuana through a multidisciplinary, client-centered, harm reduction-based practice. They've reunified over 100 refugee families ripped apart by Trump's zero-tolerance policy. Once they're reunited, they help each family find legal representation, housing, counseling, whatever they need to get on their feet. Imagine having your child ripped from your arms just because you went to another country seeking a better life, and you never know when or if you'll ever see them again, and not ever seeing them again. We can't let family separations go on. It's inhumane. And if you're like me, and you believe that families belong together and immigration should not separate them, then join me in supporting El Atrolado and donate today. You can find the link to donate to El Atrolado in the description of this episode, or go to gun.fm/charity and donate today. You can also consider volunteering with the organization, which offers opportunities both in person and virtual. The best way to get involved: fill out an application at their website, elatrolado.org volunteer. El Atrolado, ELOTROLADO.org/volunteer.
Influencer. It's a word that gets tossed around a lot these days. There is a woman who went the distance, who broke ground as the first true influencer by living a remarkable life. Her name, Elizabeth Taylor. I'm Katy Perry. This is the story of the original influencer. This is Elizabeth the First.
Elizabeth the First, the podcast, wherever you listen.
Are you together like 24/7?
We spend a lot of time together.
An unhealthy amount of time together.
I would say. We say it's because of work, but it's probably because we're afraid to live lives as individuals.
For sure.
Yeah.
Afraid, like thinking back to the law school period of like, this is better.
Yeah, it's like, imagine having your best friend with you at all times. Mm-hmm. It's pretty dope. It's just a dope experience. And we're trying to maximize that because there's going to be a moment in time when we don't have each other, so we don't want to live lives with that regret. Mm-hmm. So I'd rather just maximize my time with my brother.
Yeah, try to force our lifestyle on people who might want to join in.
When was the last time that you had a real fight?
That's a great question.
Yeah,
like a real, real fight. Maybe like a physical fight or just a...
Well, I meant intellectually, but like, you know, sure, also... I mean, have there been like...
There have been physical fights, but our last intellectual fight...
I don't even mean like, I disagree with you about Descartes, mm-hmm. but just like, Keith, I'm really mad at you that you did this, you said that, and like, well, Kenny, fuck you.
I think it was in L.A.
L.A., for sure.
When we were in L.A., we were like debating whether or not we should come back to New York.
Mm-hmm.
I was of the position that we should stay in L.A.
And I disagreed.
And he wanted to go to New York, and we sort of like had to go back and forth on why we, you know, we really had to like break down what were the advantages of staying in LA versus what were the advantages of coming back to New York. I had always missed New York, and I never wanted to stay in LA for the rest of my life, but I felt like there was some unfinished business. So, but that might have just been me.
I would say 2016, we had some really, really big disagreements just on like where we wanted to go with our careers and if we wanted to stay in LA and just how we wanted to proceed with, you know, what we were doing. So I would say 2016, we got into some big fights.
When was the last physical fight?
2016.
Yeah.
But we were like, we were doing drugs and drinking. It was a lot of just, a lot of mental health issues and substance abuse issues that I think.
That just makes you erratic.
We never really addressed growing up. So it all sort of came out while we were in LA. And, yeah, we started getting into a lot of fights. Not too many physical fights, but a lot of
arguments.
We
would go days without like, not talking to one another. Mm-hmm. I'm just like drinking in my room alone. Like, I hate that guy.
I mean, and it could have
but I really hated myself. But yeah, that was a tough year for sure,
without a doubt.
Just to be real petty, what happened in the fight and like in the fist fight?
Well, we're always, I mean, we tend to be very cognizant that, like, look,
you can't hurt the face.
We can't hurt the face.
It's the money maker.
It's the money maker.
So it's all body shots.
So it's a lot of body shots, a lot of headlocks.
We wrestled in high school, so we go back to our old.
It's more wrestling than
it's more wrestling than punching. Yeah. We try not to get too physical. But, I mean, you know, it can get intense.
But it's been a while since 2016. If you're together 24/7.
Yeah.
If I was with my best friend all the time, I think we would probably get into a melee, you know.
Yeah.
You know, at least once a month.
No, that makes sense. I mean, you spend enough time with people, you're like, I got it.
I'm just sick of you that you are always here and I need to, you know.
Yeah. We complement each other pretty well.
Yeah.
And I think we got therapy for the first time in 2016, so our fights have diminished substantially.
Yeah, we went sober and then we got therapy. We started meditating and then everything sort of just like got chill.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how's the therapy going?
Therapy's great.
I mean, it's like...
together or separate?
We started off getting it together. And we're like, this is probably not going to work. Mm-hmm. So then we separated. But we've done both. And the first time we did it, we were 31 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, it's so much, we just didn't unpack. We just decided not to talk about it. We buried it deeply into our subconscious, our unconscious.
I refuse to talk about a lot of shit like this. I just drink my pain away, but
or smoke it away.
Or smoke it away.
A lot of weed smoke.
I used to think I was above therapy. Like I don't need this. You know what I mean? Because I don't know. In the hood, it's like people don't go to therapy.
It's not for black.
It's not for black people.
It is. But
it
that is the stereotype.
I totally agree.
It's not for us, that's some white shit.
Yeah. Precisely.
But there's a lot of value in for us as for anybody.
Talking about some shit. It's like talking about the shit that impacted you. The
Do
trauma.
You have a black therapist?
Yes. Yeah.
In LA, we had a black therapist.
And have you had both?
I had a black and I had white.
And I had
an Asian lady.
Yeah. And has it made a difference having a black therapist?
Without a doubt.
Yeah.
I think so. I think a black therapist, I mean, I don't know. I just feel like it's a black guy. And I just felt like he better understood what we were going through. Maybe I'm wrong, but it just felt like I was a little bit more open.
Yeah. You feel a little more connected.
Exactly. Yeah. You feel like you can talk to him. Cause
I had this one therapist and I was trying to talk about, you know, my own marijuana addiction, and she's an older white lady and she kept calling it reefer and it would sort of take me out of the moment.
Well, you know, she doesn't smoke weed.
Not at all. And I kept trying to be like, you know, it's we don't call it reefer. And she just could not remember.
That's crazy.
Right? And it kind of broke the whole, like, you're in this moment of you know, I'm smoking weed.
Yeah, you're just
all
slightly
time.
More reserved when it's not a person of color. And I don't know, at least that's how I was.
Yeah.
It took a while to get comfortable.
Yeah.
But with a black dude, I just let it all out the first day.
So yeah. It's also like, it's hard to talk about racism when your therapist is, you know what I mean? Because, like, sometimes you're thinking, man, they're kind of a part of the problem. I don't know if they're like, I don't know if they truly understand like how serious this shit is. But at the same time,
she'll be like, "Was it all in your mind?" Like, now you're doing it to me.
Yeah, it's crazy. But then I'm also of the mind, like, how, like, can you separate the observer from the observed? You know, like we're all, you know, like on a quantum level, it's like, can you really, like, are they? are they really like independent from us and objective? Can they ever be objective? You know what I mean? Like, they're always going to like include some subjectivity in their analysis. So I'm always like uncomfortable with that, especially if it's not a person of color.
Yeah, for sure. Meditation?
Yeah.
Has it helped?
Oh, yeah.
Greatest shit.
Oh, yeah.
What do you do in twice a day?
I do it in the morning and at night.
Together?
No, not together. We do it separately.
20 minutes, 30 minutes? What do you do?
I do about 15 minutes.
I do 10, 15.
Yeah.
And then some exercise in the middle of the day. Just you know, little things like that. Maybe not little things, but things like that just to get your mind off the mind.
I started praying a little bit more, too.
Praying
I used to pray a lot when I was a kid. Like, I was a sort of a fundamentalist Christian when I was born up until about, like, 18. I was a Baptist.
We went to college.
And we went to college. Everything started changing. Yeah, philosophy made me a fucking atheist.
And you abandoned atheism and believed in God again?
I've abandoned atheism completely. I think it's wrong. I think there is some sort of higher being out there. I don't know if it's God or if it's some sort of cosmic intelligence, or I don't know if maybe it's like a kid sitting in this computer in like a fifth dimensional reality. I have no idea what it is, but I think there is something out there.
Was there a moment that you said, like, there must be something?
Started reading David Bohm,
yeah,
the quantum physicist.
Okay.
Yeah. He sort of synthesized spirituality with quantum physics and philosophy.
Yeah.
And he put it all together. I was like, wait a second, maybe he's on to something. Yeah. Maybe there is a deeper meaning to all of this, because he's trying to understand consciousness. And to him, it's like, well, what is this thing we call consciousness?
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like it's just a physical thing that's a part of the brain. It feels like it's something a little bit more cosmic.
Mm-hmm.
And I just like the way he...
He talks about the ancients. He talks about Democritus and the Stoics.
Yep.
And he connects it all with Parmenides. And he connects it to Einstein, Newton, and he says...
Wait, you had the same journey in terms of being atheist and then abandoning that
for the most part.
Bohm?
For the most part,
at the same time.
Well, I mean, he started reading Bohm,
yeah,
and I was already questioning atheism. It's just too rigid of a philosophy.
Yeah.
It's almost like fundamental. It's almost like Christianity sometimes, where it's like, I know there's nothing. I'm like, how do you know this? How do you know that there's nothing? You know what I mean? Like, anyone who's sort of fervent about their beliefs, I start to question. And I've always questioned people who were too fervent about their beliefs. And then he stumbled upon Bohm.
Yeah.
And that just answered a lot of questions for me. By raising more questions, but certainly connecting physics with spirituality, which I had never seen done before.
Yeah. The clarity in which he writes.
We live in a world where you can get anything you need delivered to your door thanks to DoorDash. If you don't want to do the dishes or you feel a little sick, let DoorDash bring dinner tonight. My family uses DoorDash all the time because it connects us to our favorite restaurants without us having to drive. Last night, we got some Indian food for my wife, some gumbo for me, and sushi for the kids. And everyone was happy, and we didn't have to do the dishes. The process of ordering was quick and easy, and I love DoorDash for real. So I was so happy to do this for them because I'm a customer, because I know DoorDash is your door to more. Must be over 21 to order alcohol. Alcohol available only in select markets. DoorDash, your door to more. Download the DoorDash app now to get almost anything delivered. In my mind, the greatest author of the 20th century is Toni Morrison. And her greatest novel is Song of Solomon, a mesmerizing coming-of-age masterpiece that is gorgeously written and has captivated readers around the world. The protagonist, Milkman Dead, was born shortly after a neighborhood eccentric hurled himself off a roof in a vain attempt to fly. For the rest of his life, Milkman is trying to fly. As Morrison follows Milkman on a quest to uncover his roots and find the place of his family's origin, she introduces an entire cast of strivers and liars and assassins and the inhabitants of an amazing, beautiful, fully realized black world. The New Yorker said Morrison moves easily in and out of the lives and thoughts of her characters, luxuriating in the diversity of circumstances and personalities. Toni Morrison is a genius. She's one of the greatest writers of her time, of the century, and Song of Solomon is her greatest book, in my opinion. It's a must-read that will ignite your imagination and show you what the best possible fiction writing is like. And it's a timeless tale that will stay with you after you've turned its final page. When you get to the climax, you will feel it in your heart. Available now at tonymorrison.com or wherever books are sold.
I had a similar moment, I think, in that I was flirting with the notion of atheism. Mm-hmm. I think I was a little bit more agnostic,
yeah,
or in between agnosticism and atheism. And I never believed there was nothing, mm-hmm, but I was like, I was definitely adjacent. Like, those people have a point. Like,
sure.
Like, who knows?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then I was doing this show where they had me doing crazy shit. That was the whole show.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, okay, we're going to go skydiving. And they pushed me out of the plane, and 4,000 feet up, the parachute comes out, and it's so peaceful. You ever been skydiving?
Never been skydiving. Is it great?
It's amazing.
Yeah.
And it's so peaceful. And the chute explodes, and it's so deeply silent. And you have such a perspective on the world. Like, the biggest building looks like an ant to us. And to be able to see the world from that perspective, I'm like, it's so large.
Mm. Yeah.
There must be some guiding consciousness.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Something bigger than us that has shaped. And is it a man who's going, you win, you lose?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No. Probably not.
But there's some force larger than us. And just the world is so big.
Mm-hmm. And intricate.
Yeah, it's silly to think it's just us.
Yeah.
And it was like this moment that sort of came to me, like in the air, like 4,000 feet above the earth, like there must be something more than us. And I was like, okay, now I am 100% certain that the atheists are wrong. There must be something. I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
And I don't know if, you know, the Christians are right or the Muslims are right or Jews or whoever. But there's something.
Yeah.
Feels like there's something.
Yeah.
The intricacies behind the universe is like a fabric that's stitched together almost perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not making an argument for intelligent design. I don't know what that is, but it just feels too perfect.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Where's your dad now?
He's in Newark.
He's in Newark, New Jersey.
Is he part of your life?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we talked to him. He has a boxing gym.
Yeah.
In Newark, he's trained in the youth, mm-hmm, and he's a good dude.
He was away for a long time.
He went to prison for 15 years.
And you talk about this in the act, so nothing new.
Nope.
You make a joke about how it affected you, but how did it really affect you having him away for 15
Terrible.
Years?
Terrible. It was awful.
What were the ages that he was away?
We were 6 when he got locked up.
Yeah.
And he got out when we were in our 20s, but it was awful because he was a good dude. He was a good father. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, he wasn't, to the law, he was a criminal, but to us, he was just a great dad. He would take us to the movies.
Yeah.
He took us to New York for the first time. He was just a silly, playful dude.
And, imagine loving something and then one day you wake up and he's gone. And you're like, fuck, what? He's not dead, but he's still here. It's just like, it fucks with your mind as a kid because it's like, he's here, but he's not here.
Yeah.
At least with death, it's like, it's finality. You learn, the grieving process, you can start to sort of, you know, begin it and work your way out of it. But
and
when
you can romanticize something.
Yeah, romanticize it. Exactly.
It's like it was like a tease. We got our dad for just a short period of time, and it was great, and then he was gone. Mm-hmm. And then it was like, holy shit, like, what do we do now?
Yeah, did you go see him?
Yeah, we did. But
that's weird.
Strange, being 6 and going to a prison. Like,
yeah.
The first major institution that you see is a prison.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, that's just, it fucks with your mind.
Because it's not the same person that you remember outside of prison. Mm-hmm. He's a different person. He's wearing the same uniform as everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
He's not as happy, obviously.
Of course, he's upset.
It's like, it's a rigid process. It's like, you have to go through 3 or 5 different waiting rooms,
mm-hmm,
and then you get there, you get 10 minutes,
yeah,
15 minutes. I mean, it's like an hour, but it feels like 15 minutes.
Yeah.
And then everything sort of controlled. You can't really, like, it's not the
people,
way you should interact with
police officer with guns.
Yeah, with like fucking AK-47s just walking around.
I mean,
like,
all of
the
that.
Fuck is this?
And plus, like, when you interact with prison, and you see, like, they've created these rules,
mm-hmm,
that are just to fuck with the inmates.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You can't walk here.
Mm-hmm.
Why not? Because we want you to walk this other way, right?
Yeah.
There's the line that like you cannot, you just can't reach the vending machine.
Yep. So,
and it's just to make the prison experience as uncomfortable.
Miserable. Yeah. Yeah. And it's not just fucking with the prisoners, it's fucking with the kids. Yeah. I mean, the kids get it even worse. I mean, yeah. It's like you have to be in this environment and it's terrifying.
Yeah. And the shame. Like that's the one thing that they never really, really speak about for kids. You feel so much shame when your dad's gone. Like I think it's even more shameful than your dad just leaving the family, because it's like not only is he gone, but he got arrested. He's a criminal. It's like you gotta deal with that burden. So we used to like make up reasons for why our dad was gone. Like he joined the military, or he's a professional wrestler, or he's on the road all the time. We would lie to our teachers just so that
because they'll ask you that question like
so what do your parents do?
Yeah, they always ask you that questions and when you have to take the standardized tests, like what do your parents do? And they're like, what?
Well, he's a career criminal. He's in prison now, and that's what he did.
It does. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. It was just they find the government finds ways to fuck with children of prisoners.
I mean, you know, a lot of people whose fathers go away end up going down that road.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How'd you have, and Newark was is very, very difficult.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How'd you escape that road?
We had a great mom. Mm-hmm. I mean, our mom worked three jobs, made sure that we hit the books, and made sure that we took education very seriously. Yeah. She was always on us about drugs, about just everything. Mm-hmm. And she was our rock. I mean, without her, I don't know where we would be.
Absolutely.
Honestly,
and not just our mom. We also had aunts.
Yeah.
Our great aunt.
And a lot of strong women.
A lot of strong women just protected us. They just made sure that we were not out there. Yep. And they just stayed on us. And they made sure we went to church. They made sure we went to class. And they made sure we achieved. And they just pushed us.
I think because they knew intrinsically probably that if we went and we had the propensity to perhaps, you know,
go down that route
like our father, because they saw it happen to him. He wasn't a bad guy. He was a very smart guy. He was very artistic. He was a hippie, but he didn't have any money. He had two kids. He's like, fuck it. I can get a quick buck selling and helping a drug dealer. And then one thing led to another. And then that was it. It's just like that in America. Like if you don't have the means to support your family and you decide to do something that's contrary to what you're supposed to do, you can end up...
Which is arbitrary if you think about it. Laws are very arbitrary. Now people are selling weed and you know, they're making billions of dollars.
It's a billion-dollar industry.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, when an African-American guy does it, it becomes a crime.
Well, David Simon talks about the notion of, like, you know, the company town, right? Mm-hmm. Certain places like a Baltimore, Newark, you know, maybe the east side of Detroit, et cetera. This is the main industry.
Precisely.
Especially the main industry for younger black guys.
Without a doubt.
And you can either be poor, or like, remember Calvin who worked at McDonald's, right? Who barely was on minimum wage.
Yeah.
Or you could be comfortable. And I'm not even talking about the myth of the teenage millionaire, right? Because that's rare. But you could have a comfortable job selling a little something.
Steady income.
You know, help out at home, whatever. And to turn your back on that when pretty much most of the people your age around you are doing that.
Absolutely.
It's very hard.
It's tough, especially if there are no other jobs in the area hiring young black guys. It's like, what the fuck are you going to do? And then you see pharmaceutical companies selling drugs and causing epidemics, making billions of dollars.
Billions,
and
trillions.
Not seeing any jail time. It's like, that just fucking distorts your perception of what criminal justice is and what you can do as a young black guy. It's like, they're literally putting their lives on the line for the money. I mean, they're getting killed at rates that are fucking staggering just to sell drugs. So it's not like it's a glamorous job. Mm-hmm. It's something
or risk-free. I mean, there's so many risks that comes with it.
So, I mean, I was late to smoking weed. I didn't start smoking weed till I got to college because I was very self-righteous in high school of like, this is bad for our community. It's hurting our community. So I don't want to be partaking in that, right?
And then had a similar,
It's like, oh, this is good. Right? So you guys had like firsthand experience of the challenges, the difficulty, the war on drugs is in the home for you, right? So when does it turn just like, well, I mean, you know, like I could be a stoner, like, you know, and mom and the aunts are like, don't ever sell and look what happened to dad. But I could be a customer. That's cool. Like, when did that happen?
It was law school.
That's when you started smoking weed?
That's when I started breaking the law.
Weren't you busy enough?
I mean, it's the stress, dude. Law school is hell. It's
and you see all the other kids. Like,
and everybody's doing drugs in law school, man.
Drinking. Everyone's doing that. So I'm like, all right.
Yeah, I smoked my first joint in law school.
Yeah.
You know, and I was like, oh, how are these motherfuckers not as stressed out as I am right now? And, you know, they were smoking weed. It took the edge off. Yeah. I mean, the shit was intense, especially that first year. I mean,
the first year is like, your entire life.
First year, they kill you.
Oh, man. For this. I mean, it's killed or be killed. Mm-hmm. It's like boot camp, and it's people were smoking weed just to alleviate some of the stress. And, I started smoking weed then.
Yeah. Started breaking the law in law school. It's the perfect time to do it. Nah, fuck it.
So then you kept on. I mean, when you get out of law school and you're doing comedy, and I say get out, you know, advisedly, because you dropped out of law school right before the end.
Yeah.
And then you get into comedy. Comedy is, I assume, not nearly as stressful, or a different kind of stress.
You know, it's a different kind of stress, but with comedy, you get to laugh some of that stress off.
That's right.
When with law school, there's no punchline. Yeah. It's just like, it's all set up.
Yeah. a lot of setup. Where the punchline at?
So how then, I mean, do you then justify it of like, hey, we're comedians. This is the life. This is part of this world.
Well, we started to cultivate these characters, these stoners, and you know, like we smoked weed, but, you know, when you cultivate a stoner character, I don't know, if it's almost as if like, as we justified the character by doing more drugs.
Yeah, and we had to prove that we were truly stoners.
Yeah.
But it was probably a confluence of things happening. We were going through depression because of law school. We dropped
PTSD.
Out. We had the PTSD of growing up in the hood and having our father leave us. It was probably like just a confluence of things happening at once. And then, you know, the stoner characters were being cultivated. And before you know it, the floodgates were open. You're fucking drinking, you're smoking, you're staying out too late. You're doing all types of drugs. And you're just like, fuck, how the fuck did this happen?
Mm-hmm.
I was a Christian boy a couple of years ago, and I didn't do shit.
Law school teetotaler.
I was that, I'm not that, and I couldn't even like. It was almost out of body. Like I see myself going down this path, and I'm like, I'm not stopping myself. Do I want to die? Like, am I ready for death?
There was certainly nihilism. There was certainly a nihilism creeping in. That's always sort of been on the surface, but it became a little bit more full blown as we became comedians. Because that sort of.
We had rejected God. Mm-hmm. We had embraced atheism. We had embraced drug
materialism.
And it's like you just see yourself going down this path of destruction. And you're like, something has to give.
And yet at the same time, the career is progressing upward.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Upward. It seems as if the more destructive we got, the better our careers were becoming. It was a strange.
How long were you dying before you started to be like, yo, we're good at this?
You mean in terms of dying on stage?
Yeah.
I mean, the first...
Because you can't not fail at the beginning of a comedy.
I would say like our jokes were pretty average, but the spectacle of being twins sort of, I don't know, made people just like, holy shit, this is definitely different and unique. And that helped us out early on. I would say we didn't really get decent until... this year.
Wait a minute.
How long between the end of law school and the Lucas Brothers Moving Company show?
3 years.
That's
3 years.
Very fast.
3 years.
Because that's where I found you guys.
Yeah,
I don't know
how
I found that show, flipping the channels, Saturday night. We came on like 11:30, 12 o'clock Saturday night. Right? Yeah. SNL sucked, right? Like, you know, it sucks all the time, but it sucked that night. Oh, wait, it's an animated show with two black guys from Brooklyn?
Yeah.
Like, they're stoners. I mean, there was so much was like, yo, this is like me. Brooklyn, stoners, like, they're intellectual, like...
Yeah. Yeah.
Yo, this is my shit right now. Yeah, like, I love these dudes. That is incredibly rapid to go from starting to getting on TV.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was 3 years in.
And it seemed like a fully formed persona on the show.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that was the character that we created. Mm-hmm. And it somehow got on TV. It was a shock to us. We did Late Night with Jimmy Fallon in 2012.
Yeah.
So that was our second year in.
Yeah.
And again, I don't think the material was any good, but it was.
I feel like our material from a it was surface level. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like it didn't really go into like core issues that I think we can mine for humor. Like we didn't really delve into a lot of the shit that we talked about, and I felt like that was part of the problem. But I felt like it was presented very well, mm-hmm. and that's good. But at the same time, like you want to grow as a comic. Like you don't want to stay a certain, like look at Chappelle. When he first started, he was a little bit more in the Def Jam mold. And, mm-hmm. you know, he was a bit more, he just wasn't who he is now. 30 years in, he's perfected the craft. I mean, and that's only because he kept challenging himself.
He's an incredible storyteller.
Oh, man. Yeah.
You can't.
Brilliant storyteller.
Like, I'm good at going to see a set and picking out some of the best jokes, and mm-hmm. I can retell those jokes. Mm-hmm. You can't retell Chappelle because it has to be a whole 30-minute setup, diversion, callback, and then the other part of the story. I mean, like, how
do you... It's intricate. It's very complex. Very intricate. Yeah. And, he's like Mark Twain almost. Yeah. I mean, I know he just won the award, but just, like, his ability to weave in different narratives into a story, I mean, it's... Yeah. I mean, it's groundbreaking.
What he talks about, like, in the struggle and what it's like to be a young African-American, now not young anymore, but he started that trend of just like really honing in on those issues for young Black men, and I don't know, he's
but
just
he doesn't
perfect.
Fall back on that. It's hard to be Black.
No,
even if he's doing like you know the crack baby selling baby on a corner, it's still not like oh it's so hard. Like a lot of that Def Jam stuff. I got real tired of it, right? And the
comic
what was
that like?
Stuff.
What was that? I mean, we consumed it, but I mean, you had to like you went through it and you had to intellectualize it. You had to try to understand.
Was it ever like a point where you're like, "This shit's not gonna last"? Like
the Def Jam stuff. Yeah. I mean, I think it got tiring really fast. There were obviously some extraordinary people,
without a doubt,
who go on there,
without a doubt.
Who was the sister who like ripped off her wig and was like, "We're gonna go beat up the guy who beat up my girlfriend," and we're riding in the truck and like, you know, I mean, like, and that was like, wow, like that was extraordinary. But a lot of them were like one step above comic view, right? Mm-hmm. Black people are like this, mm-hmm. white people are like that, you know. You know,
I always loved the acts that were like left field.
Yes.
The ones that were just eccentric.
You know, but then, of course, somebody would come out. I mean, like the infamous Bernie Mac routine.
Of course,
"I ain't scared of you motherfuckers."
Yeah.
Which was just so much power. Yeah. And just, I mean, and like it was so well constructed. I kept coming back to that note. "I ain't scared of you motherfuckers."
Mm-hmm. And that's apparently that was improv. I mean, he didn't.
I know.
Yeah, that's
so
unbelievable. Crazy about it.
And it goes, sort of the value of the ego presentation on stage of like, I'm stronger, I'm badder. I mean, some of them were extraordinary, but a lot of them would be like, "Come on, now you again." There were just so many people who are not imaginative.
Mm-hmm.
But Chappelle, man, I mean, nobody is a storyteller like Chappelle.
No, I mean, maybe Richard.
Yeah,
but other than Richard Pryor, I don't know if there's another comedian out there who can tell.
See, that's interesting because
stories.
True. But Richard, you learned about his life.
Precisely. Mm. I mean, he went there.
The childhood to to what's going on in the hospital and how it felt when they put the sponge on. Chappelle, you don't know. You know, like Chappelle in quotes. He does not talk about himself, his real self.
He started talking, I mean, he talked a little bit about his dad in the last special, which was something which was a revelation. It's like he's never talked about his dad like that.
Yeah.
So that was shocking to see.
Yeah.
But you're right. Richard Pryor was certainly more biographical.
Yeah. I mean, even what Chris Rock did in Tambourine.
Oh, yeah.
Which was not his funniest special.
You mean the second part of Tambourine?
Chris Rock is talking about why he got divorced.
I love that.
It's not the funniest,
but it's dark.
That he's done,
deep.
But it's dark and it's real. It's the most.
It's most real.
More honest than anything Chappelle has done.
Yeah. I mean,
which is not to take anything away from Chappelle, but he's not telling us about his real life.
You don't hear too much about Chappelle's real life. I mean, he talks a little bit about his son. He talks a little bit about his dad in his last special, but
kid and his wife are props in the act.
You can tell he's embellishing for narrative purposes.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's like He does that better than anyone else. Like, yeah. I don't think anyone can match that. He can tell a story like no one else. But when Rock finally went dark and deep, and it was like,
it's a revelation.
It was crazy. It blew me away.
Yeah. It blew me away.
Yeah.
I was at one of those tapings, and it was a good 30 minutes that weren't really that funny, but you were on the edge of your seat.
Yeah. He pulled the mask off.
Yeah, he pulled it off.
Yeah.
And that's what we, I mean, ultimately, that's what you're trying to do, right? Just get them to sit in the edge of their seat.
Yeah.
Right?
As a comedian, yeah, that's what you want to do. You want to be able to surprise the audience. And I think that's what Rock did. I mean, he figured out a way. And that's what's great about comedians who are getting older. They're still finding ways to surprise audiences.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think comedy is one of the few forms of entertainment where, as you get older, I think you get better, you get wiser.
Yeah.
When you're young, you're still just, it's a lot of surface level stuff. But as you get older,
you can tell Chappelle doesn't care. Like, he has nothing to prove anymore. Like,
right.
He has nothing to prove. I think when you're younger, you're like, I got to prove that I'm the best. He knows he is.
I mean, Chappelle's whole bit about Cosby and that, what was it, the age of spin?
Yeah.
And you know, I'm not, what was the thing? He's like, he saves. But he rapes.
Yeah.
Or he rapes, but he saves.
Yeah.
But he still rapes.
Yeah. That's real shit. Yeah.
And he paid for the machine that Dr. King gave all this ad. Like, oh my God. But if you still cut off 40 rapes, he still got a lot of fucking rapes. God damn. Just killing it.
Yeah.
What are some, talk about some of the bits or some of the stand up moments like that, like we're talking like Tambourine, but like that have really like stuck with you, like, yo, that is a high point of the form.
Oh yeah, just from other comedians.
Yeah.
I would say Richard Pryor's his LSD bit on what album is that?
I forget the album.
But it's an LSD bit where he's taking LSD for the first time. A white guy gives it to him, and he just starts like, oh, this shit ain't doing nothing to me, and then he just descends into madness, and then he goes into like a Space Odyssey riff, and I'm like, this is
next level.
Like this is like the, you can't do this anywhere else but what he's doing right now, and it's like it totally blew my mind.
I just heard this one bit from Eddie Griffin, who I think is completely underrated. But he says something about, because we went on this like Tupac Biggie.
We've been obsessed.
We just got obsessed with it, and He hit it on the nose. He was like, gangster rap is an oxymoron. You can't be a gangster and be a rapper.
Yeah. Because
to be a gangster, you have to move in silence.
Right.
But as a rapper, all you do is fucking talk.
Yeah.
All you do is talk about shit. And I was like, that's the insight that I was looking for. Like, how gangster rap doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, gangsters don't talk because they're committing crimes. Why would they talk openly about that shit?
What are my favorite lines in all of hip hop? Is the Lil Wayne line about real G's moving silent like lasagna?
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, does he mean like as a English major, G is silent?
Yeah.
Or do you see like lasagna like actually moving down the street in
that's
silence?
The brilliance of a
like,
Lil Wayne.
That's a great metaphor.
It's a fantastic, silly metaphor.
Yeah.
It doesn't
so
make a lot of sense.
No, it makes all the sense.
It makes
in the
all
world.
The sense. That's what I'm going to say. It makes all the sense.
So what is the Pac and Big obsession?
Man, so Pac died on our birthday.
September
13th. And Biggie released Ready to Die on our birthday.
September
13th, 1994. And
the crime bill was passed.
Crime bill was
1994,
passed.
1994, September 13th.
Yeah. So we've always, like, and I'm like a conspiracy nut. Like, I spent a year trying to figure out who killed Kennedy. Still haven't figured it out yet.
I think it was LBJ.
I think it was LBJ.
But,
and so, like, the Biggie Tupac thing has everything. It has
it's an intersection of,
it's assassination. You got hip hop. You got 90s culture. You got two of the greatest rappers to ever live. And so, some part of me believes that I moved out to LA just to figure out what the fuck happened to Biggie, because Biggie's my favorite rapper.
Yeah, Biggie. Yeah,
Biggie's my favorite rapper, and I hate L.A. as a result of them killing Biggie. I really am upset by that. And
but then, like, L.A. also killed Tupac.
Yeah,
that's what's crazy.
L.A.
Like,
killed Tupac.
He showed mad love to L.A., and they
L.A.
They
killed, gang culture, no
and
doubt.
They gang
no
killed him. So,
but we're not saying anything about L.A. gangs. No, we're fully on both sides.
Want to be able to continue to go to L.A.?
Yeah. I got nothing but love for L.A. gangsters. All of them.
All of them?
Bloods, Crips,
all of them.
All of them.
Every last one of them.
I am terrified of the motherfuckers.
Wait, how old were you in 94?
We were nine.
Nine.
Because, I mean, I remember all of that. Yeah. I mean, I lived through that. I was covering this stuff when
crazy.
It happened. I was at the Source Awards. When
no fucking
should
way.
That should, yo, Big, because I was covering
it's
Big.
So fucking, that's crazy.
He played Who Shot Ya for me. I mean, you know, he's playing it for people like months before it came out.
Yeah.
So the notion that it was way before
shooting,
Pac was dead. So the notion that it was about Pac, I'm like, no, I heard that like 3 months ago. Like, no. Nas told me that he met with Pac at the MTV Awards.
I heard the story.
Yeah. And he was like, yo, we got to come together and end this whole East West thing.
Yeah.
And like, okay. I'll be in Vegas. Oh, I'm going to Vegas. All right, let's meet on Sunday.
Wow.
And we'll talk and figure out what we're going to do.
Yeah.
And then that Saturday night, Sunday morning, it happened to Pac.
Yeah.
So there was other tentacles of it that would have happened.
Yeah, I heard that Tupac was starting to, I don't know, lose faith in the West Coast gang shit. And he wanted to try to bring people together, but I don't know. I don't know. He's
still
punching
the dude.
Yeah,
it's like it felt like everything.
Face,
so. Yeah, wait. Well, he punched the dude in Vegas. That, I wish he had never done that. I think like it's.
I mean, you know, you're coming out of a Tyson fight.
At that point
in history, those fights were the biggest jolt of testosterone
for sure.
You could have. You're marching out of a casino, which is also a testosterone jolt with Suge.
Yeah.
Right. You just got out of prison. Basically, you're trying to keep showing Suge and everybody you are that.
For sure.
I mean, like, I wouldn't be surprised that. I mean, you ever been to a fight? That is the most gendered moment in the world outside of a wedding, maybe.
Yeah,
I mean, the men are like trying to be men and the women are women, and like you feel it on 10 and like, if you see Tyson like destroy somebody, you kind of want to like, you know, I mean, I remember, you know, after Big got shot, I mean, like everybody was nervous.
Yeah.
It was like, you know, do we move? Do we run?
Yeah.
Like, you know, what do we do?
Yeah.
Because we're scared as hell.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it could happen. Who's next?
Yeah.
Because you didn't know where it had come from.
Yeah.
So, you know, so I mean, like, who's going to get shot next?
Yeah.
You know, Nas and Puff and them were like in L.A. like, do we run to the airport? Do we hide under the bed? Like, what are we going to do?
It was all crazy because he comes out with Life After Death, and the last song on the album is You're Nobody Until Somebody Kills You. And he releases going Back to Cali. I'm like, how the fuck? Like, did he know he was going to die? Like, he was always terrified of that shit. And then the shit just happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it just blows my mind.
Yeah, they already had the casket, and the hearse art.
Yeah.
Already. I mean, so yeah, it definitely was like, if that was in a movie, you'd be like,
Yeah, it's too. This like, screenwriter's taking some liberties. Fucking way.
He did.
But it's real shit.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, I don't think it's ever happened since where a rapper perfectly times his death to the point where he makes an album narrating his own death.
It's very hard to do. It's very, very hard to do. Well, also the whole thing of like a million Pac songs coming out after.
And Machiavelli and all that shit. The Hail Mary song. I mean, it was like, this dude has predicted his death.
Yeah.
So top five rappers?
I mean,
it's a tough one. I mean,
I was just thinking about this.
This is a tough one. This is like top five. It's like, why do they keep Singletons always with the ones? And
is six is easier?
I think you got to do it by era, but
sure,
whatever. If we do top five, I mean, you got to do Biggie, Tupac.
Yeah. I'm saying Jay-Z because of longevity and
output.
He's also great. Great. Nas.
Eminem?
Eminem?
Wow.
He's
great.
Eminem.
No.
No. Biggie, Tupac, Jay-Z, Nas.
See, I would just, man, I love Bone Thugs, you know? Mm-hmm. And I know that people won't put them in the
Bone
top five.
Bone Thugs in the top five?
Yeah, I know people won't put them in the top five. It's just for me, I like them. Fuck. This is a tough one.
Yeah, I think my four is set. It's Biggie, Tupac, Jay-Z, Nas.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got to pick a fifth one.
Yeah, the fifth
part of me is like Eminem because of longevity.
Then you want to be like, maybe Kendrick.
Kendrick.
Nigga got a Pulitzer.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like you got to put him in the top five. What other rapper has one?
Who's the top five comics?
Top five comics.
Stand-ups. Red Fox.
For stand up. Not for movies, just for stand up.
Red Fox, Richard Pryor,
Chappelle.
Jay Chappelle, Eddie Murphy.
Eddie.
Chris Rock.
Wait, you put Red Fox ahead of Pryor?
Oh, no, there's no order.
No order.
No, yeah, no order, but Red Fox definitely.
But I feel like Pryor is considered number one in his field, like more than Jordan is considered number one in basketball, Tiger. It's like 99% say Tiger's the greatest golfer.
Yeah.
100% are like Pryor's the greatest stand-up.
Yeah.
Change the form.
That's what Chappelle would say. That's what Rock would say. Yeah. That's what Eddie would say. They would all put...
And all the white people have to say it, too.
They have to.
Yeah.
Some people make the case for Carlin.
Carlin's great.
He was fantastic. Great.
Fantastic comedian.
What makes Pryor so great? Where's the influence?
Well, I think it's his ability to tell a story, but it's also he went there, man. Like he talked about his issues more so than any other comedian.
Nothing was off the table for him. If it happened to him the day of, he was talking about it. Like, if he blew himself up with a crack pie, whatever he did, he's talking about it.
He talked about it.
And most comics don't have that bravery that early in their career. He just went there. He went there like no other comic. And he was also a masterful joke writer and joke teller.
Yeah, what's the difference, just in general, what's the difference between being good at this and being great at this?
Well, I mean, I think... certain comedians can weave together or put together. It's like a package almost, like the unicorn in basketball, like a person who's able to shoot threes but also play defense. Mm-hmm. It's like with a comedian, like how can you tell a story? Can you write a joke? And can you perform it at the level that no one else can perform it?
Mm-hmm. Is there substance behind what you're saying?
Mm-hmm.
You can always go up there and do substance and less comedy, but are you talking about shit that's like relevant and of the time? And is it like transcendent? Like Red Fox's comedy, you can play that now, you're gonna laugh.
Mm-hmm.
Like his comedy survived. You can take another comic from that time period, and you probably can't listen to him because
he was
like dated.
In the 50s. I mean, Red Fox was doing shit that we do now.
Yeah.
And so I feel like Red Fox had that ability to not only tell a joke, but tell a timely joke that sort of it can stand the test of time.
Mm-hmm.
And Richard Pryor was able to do that, but he also...
Yeah, he took Red Fox's qualities and just multiplied them by like 100.
Mm-hmm.
He just went there.
And you're seeing that with Chappelle.
Yeah.
Like he has a little bit of Red Fox in him. He has a little bit of Richard in him.
Yeah,
and Carlin. He's put his own spin to it as well, so... Mm-hmm.
Who are the great black philosophers that you love?
Mm-hmm. Kwame Appiah is fantastic.
Kwame Appiah.
Mm,
Cornel West. W.E.B. Du Bois.
Yeah. I like Frederick Douglass. I would say he's a philosopher. I know he didn't really...
I think really... Dr. King considered a philosopher.
I think he studied
philosophy.
He was a big Hegel guy, right?
He was
Franz Fanon.
Franz Fanon, without a doubt. Without a doubt.
I mean, then would you consider Malcolm X a philosopher?
Sure.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I would consider Malcolm. He was an intellectual for sure.
Yeah, can even consider Obama, just based on his output. I mean, he's more political than he is philosophical, but he had some qualities of a philosopher.
Without a doubt,
I think he may write another piece of material that will be more philosophical than political. I would hope.
Nervous before you go on stage?
Not anymore.
No.
I used to.
Used to.
I used to smoke now I don't and drink give a shit. And like I used to have to, I had to be hammered before I got on stage.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I feel comfortable to get on stage and the things that I do, but not being nervous at all makes me nervous that I'm not taking the moment seriously enough.
I mean, you feel shit in your stomach. You naturally.
There's a physical reaction, but now it's not as mental as it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
Now I just like, I tell myself, this is just a part of the process, right? Like, this is it. This is what you've always wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And now you got it. So appreciate the moment and try not to let the nerves take away from it.
Mm-hmm.
So if I wanted to be a comedian, I was a younger guy looking up to you, what's the advice? How do you build to making it as a comic?
I would say love it. Love the grind, love the process. Study it. Study the history.
Mm-hmm. Study the greats.
And just love every second of it. Like, never take the chance to stand on stage for granted. And never laugh at someone who's beneath you, and never dismiss the advice of someone who's above you. Like, just really
soak it all in.
Immerse yourself into the
process. It's a crazy experience from the top to the bottom. I mean, every aspect of it is fairly dynamic, and if you love it, then you'll find a way to make something out of yourself. But that shouldn't be the goal, right? The goal mm-hmm. should be to, for me at least, and what I would tell others, the goal should be to have a great experience doing it.
And so long as you're not, because you're now doing comedy, you're adding to the history of comedy. Yeah. But whether you like it or not, you are part of the history. And I think we owe a responsibility to everyone who's come before us to contribute positively to it, and mm-hmm. not try to diminish the profound impact that comedy has on society. Like, continue to add to it. Mm-hmm. You know, don't take away from it.
I usually ask everybody, what's your superpower? Like, what is the thing that's special and unique about you that has allowed you to become successful?
I think it's knowing that I am not powerful.
I think it's knowing my limitations, yeah. knowing that, because I think that makes me more open to advice and more open to listening to others. I'm a sponge. I like mm-hmm. to absorb different information and keep my ears open. And I love working with other people. So mm-hmm. I think that helps as well, being collaborative. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just appreciating every moment.
Learning. Yeah. Learning is like something that I can't stress how important it is just yeah. to be able to listen to someone say something that might be fruitful or just engaging to your intellectual growth. I think that makes me a stronger person, but not more powerful, but I think it makes me a stronger person.
Thanks to Kenny and Keith for a great interview, and thanks to you for listening. Toray Show gives you fuel to power your dreams, because you can use your dreams like a rocket ship to blast you into a life you never imagined. You can make your dreams a reality, and this show can help. I'm on Twitter @Toray and on Instagram @ToreyShow. Please leave a review on iTunes. It really helps. And tell your friends about the show. Toray Show is written by me, Toray, and produced by Jackie Garifano. Our editor is Ryan Woodhall, and our photographers are Chuck Marcus and Shanta Covington. And we're distributed by DCP Entertainment. And we will be back next Wednesday with another amazing guest, because the man can't shut us down.